Yo, listen to Israel National Radio, your connection to Israel, keeping you informed 24/7.
This is Yehuda HaKohen.
And this is Eliyahu Chaim of the Zionist Freedom Alliance.
And this is a struggle for Israel's freedom on Free Israel Radio. That's right, IsraelNationalRadio.com, the only independent news network in the Middle East. That's right, the only independent news network in the Middle East. Anyone with comments or questions regarding our program can, of course, email us at struggle@IsraelNationalRadio.com. Tonight is Yud, the 10th night of the month of Kislev. 5768, Hanukkah is on the way, and we're getting excited for really any holiday that reminds us of our struggle for national freedom here in the land of Israel. Once again, the American people are on their way to elections. Presidential elections are scheduled for next year in the United States, and the darkest horse in the running today is Texas Congressman Dr. Ron Paul for the Republican nomination. Congressman Paul has come out in favor of doing away with the United Nations, with the IRS, with NAFTA, with NATO, with the World Trade Organization. He opposes the Patriot Act. He opposes Homeland Security. He also favors pulling American troops from Iraq and cutting U.S. foreign aid to other countries, including Israel. Dr. Paul was given next to no attention by the mainstream American media until successfully raising $4.2 million in one day a couple weeks ago. And now that his candidacy has gained some legitimacy, he has become a hot topic of debate among Jews in the United States. Now, Shmuel Ben Gad recently wrote an editorial for Israel National News arguing that Ron Paul is the Zionist choice for United States president. And we have Mr. Ben Gad with us on the show. Mr. Ben Gad, welcome to our show.
Shalom, thank you.
To start off, please explain to our listeners why you say that Ron Paul is a Zionist choice for the upcoming Republican primaries.
Well, I think there are two reasons. First, as you mentioned, he is a principled non-interventionist. He does not believe that the United States should intervene in the affairs of other countries unless, of course, for self-defense. He supported the war against Afghanistan, for example, but not Iraq. And I think that this is very helpful because the assistance that the U.S. has given Israel comes at a big price, which is the price that Israel is not allowed to make its own foreign policy. It comes under tremendous pressure from the United States to serve U.S. interests. This is natural. Dr. Paul doesn't believe in that sort of relationship. He believes in a relationship of trade and friendship and travel and not dictating to other countries. The second reason, I think, is also what you mentioned, and that is that he's a nationalist. He is opposed to organizations that dilute national sovereignty, like the United Nations, like the International Criminal Court. And his concern is for the United States. Obviously, if these institutions are weakened, it's helped Israel to pursue its own national interests.
Well, what arguments do you think can be made against Congressman Paul by Jews in the United States? What kind of reactions do you come up against when advocating his candidacy?
Well, there are two. The most obvious is that he is against assistance to Israel. But it's not, of course, just Israel. It's just assistance generally. And I think the attraction of having Israel having a major power sponsor and protector there's a surface value to that. There's an obvious attraction to that. I think it's meretricious. I think it's false for the reasons I mentioned, because I think ultimately it's unhealthy for Israel to think of itself as so dependent upon any other country that it doesn't operate in its own interests. But I think that I think it's a matter of fear that they know that Israel is in danger. Is an existential danger from its neighbors, and they don't see any other choice, I think many American Jews and other Zionists, than for Israel to be closely connected with the United States.
Well, you know what I personally think? I personally think that most Jews in America who lobby for foreign aid to Israel are not really concerned with Israel's long-term survival, but with their own comfort in the exile. I mean, so long as Israel is seen as America's sidekick, they have no serious issue of dual loyalty to confront. But if Israel were to become the strong and independent nation that we want her to become, and America is no longer funding us or telling us what to do, these Jews who have achieved comfort and prestige in the United States will have to seriously grapple with their loyalty, you know, with where their loyalty lies, who they're loyal to, what country they belong to. That's not a question, you know, so long as Israel is the Robin to America's Batman.
You know, actually, that's I think that's very insightful. I'd never thought of that myself. But it makes a lot of sense, at least in sort of a subconscious level. It may not be there. I mean, it may be for some people a conscious motivation. I think for some it may just be strong, but maybe they don't even realize it themselves. But I think what you say is correct.
I think subconsciously. I don't think they really think about it like that, but I think that's what really drives them. Because, you know, this relationship is clearly, I mean, anyone who looks at this objectively, the relationship between the United States and Israel is a very unhealthy relationship for both countries.
Exactly.
And we should have a relationship. I think we should be friends, but not in this way. And
that's right, it's more dependency than friendship in this way.
Right. And American Jews who support the perpetuating this relationship, I think they believe they have Israel's good at heart, but when it really comes down to is their comfort in the exile.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that is true. That, as you say, the question of dual loyalty doesn't arise in this present relationship. At least they think it doesn't arise.
Right. It still does. I mean, we know it still does. Look at the Jonathan Pollard affair and the recent problems with AIPAC. But I think it would be much more pronounced and much more obvious if Israel were distanced from America significantly, and if there was a bit of a gap and the two countries appeared as two countries, two independent nations, and not as, you know, a master and slave or, you know, a husband and concubine.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that's absolutely right, and I also think it distorts, in a way, some of the arguments that are made in support of Israel. I mean, support of Israel because it's democracy, for example.
Which is irrelevant.
Yes, it's irrelevant. The Jews have a right to their homeland, whether it's a democratic state or not.
Right. And like anybody else.
Like anybody else.
Right. And that's lost on a lot of the pro-Israel groups in America.
I think so, because, again, it's a comfortable argument to make in the context of U.S. politics.
Right, but it's temporary. Meaning, I remember once a few activists in the States, I was on a speaking tour in New York, and some college students came up to me and were talking about Israel being a democracy, like, you know, the argument you just brought up. And I asked them a question. I said, let me ask you something. Let's say tomorrow, you know, Jordan, Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, these people really became democratic. And Israel became a religious Jewish country, a theocratic Jewish state. Would we still have a right to our country? And they said, yes. So I said, so why do you go around telling people that it's because we're a democracy? That's irrelevant. It has nothing to do with it.
Exactly.
And they understood, but I think a lot of people need to be brought to under, a lot of Jews in America, and in Israel, by the way, a lot of the people in Israel who end up in the positions to voice our cause and to represent the narrative of the Jewish people, or whatever that narrative has turned into in recent years, have been stuck on this shared values argument, which between you and me and our listeners, of course, only makes Israel look like we don't belong in the Middle East. Because the more culturally Western we appear, the more we look like we're in somebody else's country. We don't belong in a neighbor.
It's like a colonial project.
Right, as opposed to the truth that we returned home to our ancestral homeland, that we are a Middle Eastern people, like the Assyrians, like the Kurds, like the Arabs, like the Druze. We are natives here. And we are the victims of Western colonialism, as the Arabs are largely victims of Western colonialism.
And I think that unless you speak clearly and honestly and truthfully about these things, you undermine your own morale, and you in the long term, you undermine your relationship with other people.
Right.
And other countries.
Now, Shmuel, I am personally against the idea of Jews voting in American elections for Zionist reasons. I mean, on principle. I think it's immoral and dishonest and an exploitation of what democracy is really meant to be. So, that being said, do you see American reasons to support Ron Paul's candidacy? Like, reasons that are good for America. Not good for Israel, but good for America.
Yes, I do. In fact, the two I just mentioned, I think, are good for the United States. And I think it's good for the United States to have friendship with other countries, to have commercial relationships commercial relationships with other countries, and not have imperial relationships. I just don't think it's in the best interest of the United States in the long term. And I think, as well, I think that the dilution of national sovereignty is an issue that an American citizen should be very concerned about. So I think the two that I mentioned, I think that are helpful to Israel, are also very, in my view, very important for the United States. Of course, you know, I agree with them on many other issues as well that have really no relationship to foreign policy.
Look, give me an example.
Well, for example, I think he's the only candidate, I think, who really takes seriously the idea of balanced budgets and financial responsibility. I mean, I have been a Republican for a number of years because it's supposed to be the party of, you know, balanced budgets and financial responsibility. It hasn't turned out to be that way, but Dr. Paul is one of those who actually takes it quite seriously. I think he's also very sound on, I think, certain very important moral issues like abortion, for example. Now, he doesn't differ from other Republican candidates in that regard on that, but and most other Republican candidates in that regard. But still, I think
well, he differs to Giuliani on that regard, no?
Yes, with the front runner, but the only one. I think where he differs most from the other candidates is obviously on interventionism and on national dilution of national sovereignty, balanced budget, and also he has a very strong belief in sound money and that inflation really is a very dangerous kind of phenomenon. It destroys people's hopes for the future. It favors a gold standard, for example.
Right. Which would essentially take a lot of power away from the Federal Reserve.
Yes, and would help preserve, I think, the value of people's money, the value of people's savings. That's very important. Mm-hmm.
And what about, you know, there's all these other issues looming on the horizon for the American people, like the USID or like the North American Union. Do you see somebody like Ron Paul being capable of obstructing these policies, being able to turn back the tide of what's been happening in the United States over the last number of decades?
Well, I think if he became president, it would be such a shock. I mean, for one thing, because this would be the most radical change that's happened since I don't know when.
Since the Federal Reserve Act.
Probably, or since Franklin Roosevelt, maybe somebody like that, and in a different way.
Since
but
Washington.
I think it would send such shockwaves. Even to tell you, even if he didn't win, but even if he performed extremely well, better than people expect, it might encourage others to take up the mantle. So I think that he could actually, in many many respects, change in a very radical way.
Change the debate.
The terms of the debate, exactly. Mm. Exactly.
Now, recently, you know, since he managed to raise $4.2 million and, you know, essentially making himself relevant, he's been attacked by a lot of Jewish groups and other groups. They try to link him to anti-Semitic movements within the United States, and they try to say that he's getting money from these people. Have you heard any of these arguments?
I have, and I think these are accusations, and I don't know how true they are. I mean, I have no idea if there are neo-Nazis who are sending him money. Who knows? You know, who knows who else they might be sending money to.
Right.
But I think that's really irrelevant, because he himself is not a Nazi. I mean, and none of his policies that he's going to implement if he becomes president are Nazi policies. So if they vote for him or if they give him money, they're not going to be getting what they want. So I don't really know. It's almost like guilt by association. I suppose you can find nuts who support any candidate,
right,
if you really look for them carefully. There are nutty people who support any candidate, just because that's the way politics is. It attracts a certain number of, you know, nuts.
And it could be that they support him because he's opposed to gun control, he's opposed to domestic, spying, and these are obviously policies that would be attractive to people. You know, whether they be, you know, Muslim extremists or white supremacists or even Zionists sometimes. I mean, you know, I don't think that any government has a right to spy on me, to check my emails, to listen to my phone conversations. And I think that that resonates with a lot of people who do have something to hide and a lot of people who don't have something to hide.
That's true. And so they can support them for many reasons. Even if they support them for bad reasons, though, it doesn't make his...
Doesn't make it anti-Semitic.
Bad. No, he's not, as far as I can tell.
Right. I've seen no evidence that he is, but a lot of people now are trying to tear him down. And it's funny because the system, the establishment that a candidate like Ron Paul is trying to tear down in America, he's essentially trying to tear down everything that went wrong with the United States. And historically, a lot of people who have tried to do what he's trying to do have been accused of anti-Semitism.
Well, it's that, you know, when you accuse people of those kinds of things, or any or even character assassination, it means you don't have to address their arguments. And I think it's just an easy way not to address somebody's arguments, to dismiss them as sort of out of range of being considered seriously. And this is why I think that now that he's running, you know, in the Republican primary, he ran as a Libertarian candidate, espousing much of these same positions in 1988. And he said in an interview, nobody took him seriously, because he was a member of some small little party that didn't matter. Now that he's running as a Republican, even though his chances, let's face it, are not great, I mean, he might win, but it would be a surprise.
I hope so.
Because he's in those debates and because he's running in that field, they have to take him seriously.
Right.
And so some people try to tear him down by character assassination or by making these wild accusations.
Right. Now, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? I know that you work in disseminating the writings of Professor Yisrael Eldad in English, and as leaders in the Zionist Freedom Alliance, both Eliyahu and myself are students of Eldad. Anyone who goes to our website, www.zfa.org.il, can clearly see this. Can you tell us a little bit about how you discovered Eldad's writings and how you work to spread them?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I grew up in a Zionist home, but we really were not aware, at least I wasn't aware growing up, of the sort of the differences of the gradations within Zionism, the various types and so forth. Later, a friend of mine who wanted to sort of instruct me in these kinds of things recommended some books and so forth, and I learned about Jabotinsky and the Jabotinsky movement, and he seemed so pure and a natural patriot. I mean, there were no sort of convoluted, he didn't need any convoluted reasons to love his people and love his country and fight for them. He didn't need that. It was just pure, and it was simple, and it was clear, and it was very attractive to me. It just seemed to be natural to me, a natural way of doing it. And when I was reading about him, I was reading how much opposition he faced. I mean, it was just incredible to me. I couldn't believe it and couldn't understand it, and it's hard for me to understand to this day. And it was really through him, of course, that I was exposed to a number of other thinkers, including Dr. Eldad. One of the things that I've learned, I mean, his thought is very rich, but one of the things that I found very helpful for me personally in his thought is that if you look at Zionism in particular, and you see that there's a logic to it, and the logic is Hebrew sovereignty over the entire land of Israel. That's the logic of it. That's the logic of the whole movement. And even though it always seemed to many people to be a dream or unnecessary or these kinds of things, this is the logic of the movement. And if you follow that logic, you strengthen yourself. You strengthen yourself as a country. You strengthen yourself even individually as a member of the nation, of the Hebrew nation. If you don't do that, you wind up going in reverse, which is what I'm afraid we're seeing now. So the idea that somehow you can, that it's simply a territorial dispute amenable to compromise, I think he saw through that. And I think he saw through that because he saw that the enemy would never believe that. And while would never believe that we'd be just satisfied with being, you know, having Tel Aviv, being a Singapore in the Middle East. And it's just not survivable. In fact, in one of his writings, if I may just say something, he talked about that the state of Israel, with its regime, frontiers, and objectives, is not a long-term possibility if it does not serve as a real basis for achieving the objective of Malchut Yisrael, the Kingdom of Israel. It is not a reality at all. And I think that's a very realistic assessment of Israel when he wrote it, which was in the early 60s or late 50s maybe, and now.
Right. He said that the state of Israel is not the goal of Zionism, but a tool with which to achieve the goals of Zionism,
exactly,
which is the Kingdom of Israel in our ancestral homeland.
Exactly. It's very beautiful. It's very insightful, I think. And I think that subsequent events have just shown more and more how true that is.
Now, how are you working to disseminate Dr. Eldad's writings?
Well, there is, it's a little hard to do, because some of them are not in print anymore. For example, Israel, the Road to Full Redemption, is not in print, as far as I know, certainly not in English, and as far as I know, not even in Hebrew anymore.
I recently got a copy in English, by the way.
Oh, you did?
I managed to obtain it from somebody, in Israel.
You're lucky.
Oh, excellent.
And they just reprinted the Jewish Revolution, of course, and they're reprinting Moshe Rishon in English.
Which is wonderful. So there is actually Israel Eldad listserv. It's a Yahoo group, israeldad@yahoo.com. And that's where people interested in Israel Eldad can.
For our listeners, that's ISRAELELDAD at yahoogroups.com.
I think it's just at yahoo.com.
At yahoo.com. Okay.
I think it's just at yahoo.com. And there, it's a small group, and there they can have discussions about those sorts of things. And there's been some, every now and then there's talk about trying to get things republished or translated right. and things of that sort. But
And I, of course, urge our listeners to go to saveisrael.com with a lot of Dr. Eldad's writings in English.
In fact, the same person who runs, thank you for mentioning that, I forgot, the same person who runs the listserv runs that, and that has a lot of his writings translated. You're absolutely right.
I found it very helpful, just, you know, for my own education.
Oh, did you as well?
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, he's tremendous.
Now, do you see a connection between your devotion to Eldad's teachings and your support for Congressman Paul?
Well, I think in the sense that, you know, as a nationalist, and it goes to, and which he was, I mean, like Jabotinsky, I think, just sort of a pure natural nationalist, I can appreciate and respect other nationalists. And, of course, I'm an American citizen as well, so it's important to me. And I think that, you know, I can really respect, the idea of having respect for other countries, loving your people doesn't mean you hate anybody else,
right.
or that you want to you want to commit an injustice against anyone else. And I think so Ron Paul is wonderful in the sense that he just wants to have friendly relations with other countries. I mean, of course he's not against self-defense or anything of that sort, you know. But he wants to have friendly commercial and travel and relationships of travel with other countries and respects the nationality, the legitimate aspirations of other countries. And I think any sort of non- imperialistic nationalists can really appreciate that. I know I do.
Well, when can we expect to see you in the land of Israel?
Well, I hope very soon. I hope very soon, but I don't know. I'm not sure at this point. It's just I've actually visited 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And
ever? 3 times in your life?
Only three times in my life,
okay.
I'm afraid. And actually, I went there sometimes a little before I was sort of what are called Jabotinskyites. So before maybe my consciousness was as fully nationalistic as it is now, it certainly helped being there. And so one of the things I regret terribly is that I never, when I was there, I went to the Kotel and not on Har HaBayit itself. And that's something I would definitely like to do.
Well, I'll tell you what. I live very close to Har HaBayit. And
mm-hmm.
next time you're in Israel, you feel free to contact me, and hopefully I'll make a couple of days to take you around the country and show you the kinds of things I think you'll be interested in now that you're aware of the details of the Zionist revolution and our struggle for freedom. Shmuel Ben Gad, thank you so much for being with us. Hopefully we'll bring you back soon in the future, and you keep us updated through email what's happening with Congressman Paul in the States.
Will do. Thank you very much, Mr. Akhlan.
Shalom.
Goodbye.
Well, what do you think?
That's stuff that I've been screaming about for a while. I didn't want to say anything because I just wanted to hear other people say stuff. You know, it's the same, exactly the same things, mamash, of what I've been saying before I became a Zionist, before I started doing Tshuva, when I was just politically aware in the States and what was going on and what I felt and what the people in my community felt.
Right on. We're about to take a break now, but hopefully our listeners will stay with us here on the struggle for Israel's freedom on IsraelNationalRadio.com. Join us when we come back. We'll talk a little bit about what Shmuel Ben Gad told us. Stay tuned.
Do you love books? Do you love Jewish books? You need JudaicaBooks.net, the best source on the internet for new, used, and rare Jewish books. All books are hand-picked by JudaicaBooks.net owner and Jewish book expert Rabbi Yaakov Shmaria. So whether it's a 5-volume set in Hebrew or the latest from Art Scroll, fiction, or children's books, JudaicaBooks.net is for you.
We are back on IsraelNationalRadio.com. This is Yehuda.
This is Eliyahu.
And this is a struggle for Israel's freedom. Now, we had Shmuel Ben Gad in the last half talking about why he supports Congressman Ron Paul for president. What are your thoughts, Eliyahu?
I think it's a good choice for Americans that do have Israel in mind or don't have Israel in mind, just for America's own security, America's own progress. It needs to be brought back to its real ideology, and it's been lost in past
that
decades.
That being the ideology of the founding fathers
of
the United States.
Absolutely. Yeah, Ron Paul has the closest in line to what that original ideology was, And lately it's been the international banks, private banks that have been running the show. The gold and silver standards removed. And
national sovereignty has been eroded.
National sovereignty has been eroded in America, and they aim to do that all over the rest of the world.
Certainly the sovereignty of individual states have been eroded.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As far as the way that it was supposed to be before, the government at whole was not supposed to interfere so much with the states' rights in American, the way it was first set out in America. Now everything is more in the collective government. It's a bigger government than any of them wanted. They wanted small government to begin with, but it's been lost. And Ron Paul wants to pretty much bring it back to how it was supposed to be, when it was actually something worth being proud of.
To what America was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And what America can be.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't care so much for America anymore. I'm in Israel, thank God. This is what I'm more concerned with here.
Right,
however,
right,
there are a lot of our brothers and sisters over there.
And there are a lot of good people who live in America who are
not
part of the Jewish nation.
Absolutely.
And they deserve to have the country that the founding fathers charted for them. And there's no reason why they should be living under a fascist regime, and there's no reason why they should be living, you know, in a country that violates their civil liberties or personal rights, you know, whether in the name of security or whether in the name of big business or the name of globalization.
Yeah, they should be concerned with their own progress.
And I think that Ron Paul is, from what I've seen, probably the only American candidate who is looking to return the United States of America to the original vision of the founding fathers.
Nachon.
Now, here in Israel, our political leadership has dropped the bomb.
Yeah.
They're essentially, you know, to everybody's shock, saying that our recognition of the rights of the Arabs who now call themselves Palestinians is dependent on their recognition that what's left of Israel will be a Jewish state. Now, this is a, you know, I mean, to you and I and probably many of our listeners, this doesn't sound like such a big deal. It should be a given. And, you know, the opposite. We're opposed to our government giving away parts of our country. We obviously don't recognize national rights of the Arabs who now call themselves Palestinians. It's a national identity that was invented only a number of decades ago for the sole purpose of eradicating Israel. But now, by coming out and saying this, that you, the Arabs, must recognize that Israel is a Jewish state, suddenly, for the first time in all these negotiations,
you can see a little bit of backbone, maybe.
Israel is presenting demands. Now, we have with us on the line political analyst Mordechai Taub. Mordechai, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
Now, Mordechai, it's no secret that our current political leadership has been very cooperative with the international community regarding shrinking the borders of the state of Israel. But now, suddenly, these leaders are demanding that the Arabs accept the truncated borders of Israel that the world is demanding we withdraw to as a Jewish state. What political factors are behind these demands, and what effect, if any, do you see them having in the long term?
First of all, I'm not so sure that there's any set as agreement as of yet. There clearly is an understanding between the current administration and the United States and the so-called Palestinians that Israel is willing to give away part of its patrimony, part of the land of Israel. Politically, there's two factors that come into play here. There's the negotiations. When you sit down and negotiate with someone, you want a minimal set of plausible rules. You know, as if someone would say openly that they're going to sign a contract, but they won't keep the contract. Okay? So to recognize Israel as a Jewish state is to recognize they have been claiming it's illegitimate.
Who has been claiming?
They have not been claiming until now that we have a dispute over land.
Who has been claiming?
The Arab negotiators. They haven't said as of now that there is a certain dispute, that there's a particular parcel of land that you claim as yours, we claim as ours. They have been saying that the entire state is not legitimate. So if they wish to sit down and negotiate, if they wish to receive concessions, it's legitimate to first ask them to agree to a basic parameter of negotiations. That's the first part. The second part is Ehud Olmert formed a coalition. He formed a coalition with various parties. He went to what was the center left of the political parties, and those on the right of his coalition have to justify politically their being there. They have to go back to their voters and say, listen, we went with someone who is significantly to the left of our position, but we had a tremendous
impact
on him. And this is part of the impact they plan on bringing back to their voters.
So you think this is a concession to Yisrael Beiteinu and Shas on Olmert's behalf?
I think if they were not in the coalition,
he would have said it.
This demand would not have existed.
Uh-huh. And Tzipi Livni is also running her mouth on this demand. I mean, to everybody's, you know, shock. Here you have Foreign Minister Livni getting up and saying that the Arabs will have to accept that what's left of Israel will be a Jewish state. I mean, is this something that you expected from a personality like this?
Well, until recently, she hadn't really established a particular position.
On anything?
Even on foreign policy matters.
And she's a foreign minister.
And this is part of the policy. This is part of a process of her staking out her position. Obviously, I believe she believes what she's saying. You know, I don't think I'm that cynical that I think that she has no belief. But clearly, as she looks at the political map and where she's positioned within the Kadima Party, which she's attached her future to, this will has a significant impact on where she positions herself.
Now, do you see any of this as an attempted backtrack for Olmert or Livni in terms of trying to weasel out of their commitments regarding Annapolis? I mean, could they have just woken up and realized, wait, we've gotten ourselves and we've gotten our entire country in trouble here. Let's try to come out with something that we know the Arabs will reject so we can just scrap the whole idea.
Clearly, while of being of a much higher character, as politicians, they never learned what Arik Sharon had forgotten in his lifetime. Arik Sharon was used to getting up and making set commitments by set dates without any intention of ever meeting many of those commitments. Arik Sharon would have easily said, we're going to Annapolis and we're doing 1, 2, and 3, knowing that he had already a way of not going there and not committing that. They're not Arik Sharon. They simply they don't have the political ability to manipulate whether it's foreign leaders or the Israeli public that he did.
Okay. I didn't realize that Sharon had the ability to manipulate any foreign leaders.
Yeah.
But he was certainly a big fish in his own small fishbowl.
Yeah.
That being the state of Israel. Now,
I believe they're in trouble. As we've clearly indicated, in a general level, Ehud Olmert made a strategic decision, and what he believed was good for the country, that he was going to go along with American policy, that he was going to be George Bush's junior partner in the fight against world terror. And he realized that in that process, he would have to make certain concessions and do certain things that might not be directly in the interest of Israel, but would, in theory, be for the general good. What had happened is he let the Americans know he was doing this, and Condoleezza Rice simply has pushed it too far. She's not only asking him to make concessions that would help the fight of world terror, she's asking him to make concessions that would be totally destructive to Israel.
Right, and, you know, this is why I personally think this whole idea of a war on terror is nonsense. You know, just as World War II wasn't a Jewish war. I mean, the Allies, the British and the Americans, were fighting the German war machine, but they were never fighting the Gestapo. They were never bombing the camp. So, too, you know, President Bush's war on terror, you know, might be invading Arab countries and Muslim countries all over the world and might be, you know, stripping the Muslims and other people as well who live in the United States of their civil liberties. But they're still trying to push Israel to surrender. Here, there's no war on terror. Here, there's a drive to capitulate and surrender parts of our ancestral homeland, including our capital, to the very terrorists that Bush, you know, you would presume, is crusading against. Now, I want to switch gears a little bit, talking about American politics. Earlier on the show, we had Shmuel Ben Gad, who created a big sensation last Friday on Israel National News, with his op-ed calling Ron Paul the Zionist choice in the upcoming U.S. elections. This op-ed received 100 talkbacks as of today, and there is heavy debate all over the Internet as to how good or bad Congressman Paul would be for the Jews in America and for the state of Israel. In your opinion, Mordechai, what are the key issues here?
First of all, let me add to that. Even when Ron Paul speaks about things that in theory have nothing to do with Israel, he generates more responses on the Internet, pro and negative, in the United States. One of the reasons for this is while some of his points are valid and might help, he's taken certain ideas to an extreme. I believe the United States has attempted to micromanage many foreign policy questions to an extent.
Foreign policy questions of other countries.
One second, right, which they simply don't have the wherewithal or the public will to deal with, or even the ability to be involved militarily in that many places, even as the most powerful nation in the world. And Ron Paul has called for stepping back. I believe his calls for stepping back is extreme in the other direction. He speaks about no involvement. No involvement for the United States is also naive and impossible in today's world where everything is so close. So while his point and the direction that he's pointing are valid and I believe are in the interest of the United States and would be in the interest of Israel, I think the extreme level of his call has generated the vociferous responses.
From Jews or anybody?
Anybody.
Right.
Anybody. In general, if you were to go to anywhere on the Internet that was related to American politics in general, anytime Ron Paul comes up, there are significant, whether political side or the New York Times, he generates a significant amount of pro and anti-responses.
Right. Now, regarding the Jewish community, especially the establishment in America, the American Jewish establishment, most notably the Anti-Defamation League and AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, I asked our previous guest if he thought that maybe a lot of their opposition to Ron Paul, and more specifically their opposition to ending American foreign aid to Israel, has very little to do with Israel's interests and is more to do with their sense of comfort. I feel that Mordechai.
Sure.
I think that a lot of American Jews feel, or maybe subconsciously, that they don't have a dual loyalty question so long as Israel is seen as America's sidekick in the Middle East. And if Israel were to become a strong and independent country, the strong and independent country we want Israel to be, there might be a much bigger question of dual loyalty for American Jews.
You mentioned a specific organization, so let me first answer on a specific level and then on a general level.
Okay.
You mentioned AIPAC. AIPAC has clearly identified itself as supporting the policies of the current Israeli administration, whatever that might be. So you can't then go ahead and blame them for doing so. There's a role for an institution that would support the policies of the administration of Israel, irrespective of that might be, and they're fulfilling that role.
Well, but that's not their actual. But that's not their.
I don't think the criticism is valid in that specific case. Now, when you speak at a general level,
wait, Mordechai, before you move to the general, AIPAC's official mission, to my knowledge, is to strengthen and perpetuate the relationship between America and Israel. I mean, they might also support the policies of whoever's...
They clearly say, yeah, when they speak publicly, they clearly say that on policy issues,
yes,
that's the role of the Israeli
okay,
government.
That's legitimate.
And they support whatever policy decision the Israeli government makes.
Right, but their big role as a lobby group in Washington is to strengthen the relationship as it exists today between the United States and Israel.
On a practical level, when one lobbies, one doesn't bring simply brochures how Israel is a nice place. One lobbies on the very specific legislation and very specific issues. So if Israel is perhaps has a specific policy, then that is affected by American legislation, they're lobbying for that particular legislation.
Right, but my argument here is that legislation is bad for Israel. AIPAC is strengthening a relationship, or legislation in particular, that's hurting Israel. The money coming from the United States to Israel.
You and I, as Israelis, might disagree with that particular American policy. That's correct. But they, as Americans, are fulfilling a particular role that in general is positive.
But do you believe that stems from a genuine concern for Israel or desire to have no, you know, future schism and no future gap between
the two countries?
So let us
speak at a general level of the identity of those American Jews who don't feel necessarily totally confident. As Americans, what they want more than anything else is that there shouldn't be tension between America and Israel.
Exactly.
That is the worst thing that can happen to them. They don't want...
They don't want to make the choice.
Right. They don't want trouble, and they don't want noise, and they don't want argument, and they don't want an American president saying something critical about Israeli policy, and they don't want an Israeli prime minister saying something critical about American policy. That makes them very, very uncomfortable. And therefore, so in the recent war, when there were a number of those who were actually anti-Semitic commentators who would somehow indicated that the war was played out in Iraq because of Israel's interest, that raised the hoop from the Jewish public that insisted that it wasn't. Because, again, that would lead to a tremendous amount of tension for them in the American public, and they clearly don't want that tension.
Now, Ron Paul wants to cut American aid to all other countries, including Israel, but he also wants to stop telling Israel what to do. He wants to stop interfering and, as you said, micromanaging the foreign policies of other nations.
So here is where... I believe there is a place for Americans to say that as a like-minded democracy and an ally over all these years, we are supportive of Israel. We're not equal. On the other hand, I believe there's also a place for foreign aid to be cut across the board to all countries in the world and stop micromanaging. And it clearly is in America's interest. Irrespective of any policy decision that another country takes outside of the United States, it will have effect. It will have life and death effects. Any decision that Prime Minister Olmert makes in militarily and foreign policy will have life and death effect in the country. And that's the role of the leaders and the government of a country, that the United States should be involving itself on these life and death questions is not good for the long term for interests of the United States. That being said, there are certain cases. This is not where I think Ron Paul has gone too far. This is not something that can be taken to an extreme. There are governments that are not stable, and it is clearly in the interest of the United States to help stabilize those governments. And if stabilizing those governments means giving a certain amount of aid, I think it's a positive action.
Well, regarding Israel specifically, would you agree that it's far better from Israel's perspective to have a president like Ron Paul than to have someone in the White House who treats us like a concubine in the Middle East? I mean, Ron Paul has actually said that Israel has become like a vassal to the United States and we must become an independent state. I mean, how could somebody argue with that?
Right. That statement in and of itself is a positive statement. But the two alternatives that you gave are not the two alternatives that exist.
Well, do you see a middle ground?
I sure do.
And who would represent that middle ground?
I think there are numerous options that represent the middle ground. I think there are numerous options that don't want Israel as a vassal state, that want it as an independent state. But and on the other hand, don't wish to totally remove themselves from what happens in the Middle East.
Now, I wanted to ask a question. Just, you were an activist for a long time in American politics. Let's say Ron Paul does become president. Now, he wants to, you know, pull out of the UN, pull out of NATO, NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, wants to get rid of the IRS. How easy will these things be for him to do as president? I mean, is the executive branch that powerful, or will his ability be limited to carry through those policies?
The difference between Israel and America, and it's true, is that America's system is built to be slow-moving intentionally, because every time America sneezes, the world has an earthquake. Israel is a country under constant threat, and therefore the system is built so that a prime minister at 2 o'clock in the morning can make a very quick decision about the security of the country.
All right, Mordechai. I think that was very helpful to both me, Eliyahu, and our listeners. This was a struggle on IsraelNationalRadio.com, the only independent news network in the Middle East.